constrained to talk about the Exodus of Egypt and various aspects of this. And again, I claim as my defense, Ein Mukdam Umu'uchar BaTorah, that the Torah does not follow chronological sequence, and therefore we have that liberty as well. Specifically, though, I want to talk about an issue that pertains both to the biblical narratives and to the structure of the Haggadah itself. Now, we know the Haggadah itself is not from the Torah. Obviously, it quotes verses from the Torah, and it quotes Midrashim, and it is a work that is based on the biblical and Talmudic and Midrashic sources. And the Haggadah itself is a very, very old document. The Haggadah itself dates from the time of the Mishnah, at least no later than 200 of the Common Era, and again possibly even much earlier. But what I'd like to talk about basically is what you might call the deep structure of the Haggadah and what is the model that it is based on. First of all, we know that one of the 613 mitzvot of the Torah is a mitzvah that is called Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim. This is a commandment in the Torah that the anniversary of the liberation of the Egyptian slavery, the 15th of Nisan at night, there is a mitzvah that we should recount to our families and even to ourselves, if we are by ourselves, the Sipur, the narrative of Yitziat Mitzrayim, right? The basis of the Seder, which has many other things as well, eating this and that, but the foundation of the Seder is it is the ceremony in which we fulfill every year anew the biblical commandments, one of the 613 commandments of the Torah, of recounting the Exodus of Egypt. Where does the Torah say there must be an annual mitzvah called Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim? From a verse, "Yigadatel levincha bayomahu leimar," you shall tell, and that's where the word Haggadah comes from. "Yigadata," Haggadah. "Yigadatel levincha bayomahu leimar," you shall tell your child on that day, in other words, the day of the Exodus, leimar, stating, "Bavor zeh asa Hashem li," because of all that God has done for me. It's a team in Mitzrayim. When I was taken out, the I emphasizes that we have to feel that we ourselves were taken out. It's a team in Mitzrayim. That is why I am doing all of these things. And Maimonides points out that, well, how do we know that there is a mitzvah even if you don't have a child? Literally, the Torah says there's a mitzvah, "V'yigadata lebincha," you shall tell your child. How do I know that if I'm by myself, or I don't have a child, or my children are at the in-laws for Passover, whatever the situation might be, how do I know there's a mitzvah of Haggadah? So Maimonides makes the point, because there is in fact another pasuk that says, "Zachor et hayom hazeh, asher yitzatzen in Mitzrayim," remember the day that you left Egypt. And that other pasuk is filling in what would have been an erroneous implication. If you just would have had the verse, "V'yigadata levincha," you might have made a mistake. You might have concluded that you only make a Seder when there are children. By the way, this is an interesting theological common mistake that Jews make anyway, where they think Judaism is for my children. Meaning, what I do doesn't make a difference, but I just got to be sure that they go to Hebrew school and everything else. Well, in order to negate that 20th century mistake, the Torah makes the point, you must remember and recount the Exodus, even if you're by yourself, although there's obviously a special mitzvah when you have children. So collectively, these two psukim furnish the biblical basis for a mitzvah called Haggadah, the mitzvah of Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim. Now, the precise text to be recited, however, is not of biblical origin. Meaning, as far as the Torah is concerned, as long as one does the story, they could do it in their own way, in their own words. It's very similar, for example, to what Maimonides writes is the institution of tefillah. Maimonides writes that there is a mitzvah in the Torah to pray to God. One is obligated to recite prayers to God. But the Torah does not dictate what form those prayers could take, and each person could pray in their own words. Later, the rabbis tried to give us a standardized liturgy. Well, the Haggadah follows the very same format. The Torah requires that there be a narration, but it does not in and of itself give us a standardized liturgy. And we have a standardized liturgy known as the Haggadah, which is remarkably constant, you know, among all the different groups, Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Obviously there are different minhagim, different customs here and there, and slightly different wordings, but the Nusach of the Haggadah is a remarkably constant and consistent document among all the Eidots, all the different congregations. Now, here is the question. There is another mitzvah about the Exodus that is a little less known to us, and that is there is a mitzvah every single day of the year to remember the Exodus of Egypt in a verbalized way. This is called Zechirat Yitziat Mitzrayim, and this is derived from a pasuk that the Haggadah itself makes reference to, that says, Laman Tizkor et Yom Tzeitcha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, that you must remember the day that you left Egypt, Kol Yemei Chayecha, all the days of your life. Remember that passage of the Haggadah, where at the very beginning of the Haggadah, before people are too drunk or tired, it mentions over there, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah remarks, Behold, I am like a man of 70 years old, and I was never able to convince the sages of the need to talk about the Exodus at night until Ben Zoma came and offered an interpretation. Zoma is a rabbi. He offered an interpretation of a verse that says, you must remember the Exodus of Egypt all the days of your life. If it just would have said the days of your life, that might have meant the days. What is the extra word, all the days of your life? To include the night. Now, here is something that if you read the Haggadah, you know, it may not occur to you, and that is, that paragraph has absolutely nothing to do with the Seder. Because what's going on? Was there a dispute whether the Seder should be done at night or in the day? Of course not. Everybody made a Seder at night. That dispute does not pertain to the mitzvah of Haggadah at all. That dispute pertains to the mitzvah every single day to remember the Exodus, every single day, where according to one opinion, the primary obligation is in the daytime, because that is when the Jews left Egypt. According to the other opinion, you have to do it at night as well. And the whole machloket, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and the sages, does not pertain at all to the Haggadah. It pertains to the other mitzvah, which is the mitzvah of Zechirah. Now, I'll leave you with two questions that I don't want to elaborate on. I'll just leave you with two questions to think about, and you could maybe discuss at your own Seder. Question number one is, why is that paragraph in the Haggadah at all? Question number two is a little bit of a deeper question, and that is a paradox. And that is the following. It turns out you have a tremendous asymmetry between the special mitzvah of Haggadah and the everyday mitzvah of Zechirah, because the special mitzvah of Haggadah is only at night and not in the day. You don't make a Seder in the day. And yet the mitzvah of Zechirah is in the day, and according to some opinions, not at night. And Ben Zoma says we also include the night, but it's very clear that in Zechirah, the primary mitzvah is daytime, and nighttime is a secondary mitzvah. And yet, when it comes to Sippur, it's exactly the opposite situation, where not only is the primary mitzvah at night, but the exclusive mitzvah is at night. You don't make a Seder in the day. Why is there a dichotomy? Why is there a contradiction between the mitzvah of Sippur or Haggadah and the mitzvah of Zechirah? Okay, I'll leave that as a question, because the answer would be would take the rest of the hour, and I want to talk about something else. But it is a question that one should think about, and it's one of those things where you read this paragraph of the Haggadah over and over again every year, and as I say, people are reading it when they're relatively clear-minded. And yet, if you just think about what on earth it is talking about, it's not talking about the Seder at all. So why is it there? Okay. But be it as it may, though, we do have in Halakha two distinct mitzvot. A mitzvah of Zechirah every day. And how do we fulfill that mitzvah? If you say the Shema in the third paragraph of the Shema that is recited, Shacharit V'Arvit, there's one verse that's very important, and many verses that are important, but this verse is, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am the Lord your God, Asher Hotzeti Etchem Me'eretz Mitzrayim, who took you out of the land of Egypt, Liyot Lachem Le'elokim, to be for you a God, to be for you your God. Now, that is a mitzvah. When you say that verse, you are fulfilling a biblical mitzvah called Zechirat Yitziat Mitzrayim. So, here is the question. If indeed there is a mitzvah every single day to remember the Exodus, and if the halakha says that that mitzvah is not only in the daytime, but it's also at night, then what is the Torah telling me to do the night of Pesach through Sippur that I wouldn't have to have done anyway? Now, you can't answer, well, I got to say a whole Haggadah. But once again, the fact that I have to say a whole Haggadah, that is not required by the Torah itself. So the question is, if you only had the biblical commandment, what is the mitzvah of Haggadah superimposing on what you already would have to have? Remember, Pesach night is not worse than any other night of the year. Every night of the year, I got to mention the Exodus, as well as every day of the year. So, if I was a person who only wants, let's assume that I'm a person, this is an improper attitude, that says, I want to do the minimum Seder that the Torah says I can get away with. I want to do the biblical commandments. I don't want to do the rabbinic innovations. So, I want to know, can I fulfill the Seder by reciting the same verse? I am Hashem who took you out of Egypt? Is that it? Or, is there something in the mitzvah of Haggadah, even as a biblical minimum, that goes beyond what you could get by with in terms of Zechirah? Now, the truth of the matter is, in some early commentaries, there is actually an intimation that you could get by with the short form, right? Now, income tax is coming up, so we have the 1040A and the 1040, right? So there are some Rishonim, some early commentators that intimate that at least on a biblical level, one could fulfill the Haggadah with a short form. One sentence would have been sufficient. In fact, there are some commentaries that actually go so far as to suggest that in the Kiddush, in which you only mention the Exodus in three words, you say, Zecher Litziat Mitzrayim, you have done the minimum Haggadah requirement. Of course, the question then becomes, so what is Sippur adding to Zechirah, which I would have had to do anyway? They say this in connection with another question. Again, I don't want to get into this question too much. I will throw it out. So these are things you could ask your kids or discuss. That is, a question that many commentators ask is, if there is a mitzvah in the Torah called Haggadah, why do we not recite a blessing on the Haggadah before we say it? Why don't we say, before Kiddush, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu L'saper V'yitziat Mitzrayim. God has commanded us to talk about the Exodus. You know, we make a bracha before shofar blowing. We make a bracha before Megillah reading. We make a bracha before Hanukkah lighting. We make a bracha on Talit and on Tefillin and all of these things, lighting Shabbos candles. Why don't we make a bracha on the commandment of the Haggadah? It is a commandment. We make a bracha on the Matzah and on the Morah. What about the Haggadah itself? Right. So that's a question. But one of the answers that is given to this question is this idea that you only make a bracha on mitzvot that have a minimum quantity that must be said or must be done. And since Haggadah you could fulfill with just one word, there's no bracha on that. But that's one of the answers that is given. But that seems to be inconsistent with the fact that if the Torah gives me a new mitzvah called Sippur, it must be going beyond Zechirah. If it's only the same as the minimum idea of Zechirah, then what's the point? What new mitzvah is it giving me? You know, matzah, everything else, but in terms of Haggadah, what new mitzvah is it giving me? So therefore, because of this, many commentators make the point that obviously, even though the Torah does not mandate that you say the exact Haggadah that we have, there must be elements in Haggadah that go beyond merely mentioning that God took you out of Egypt. Because that would have been picked up in Zechirah, which you'd have to do anyway. There'd be no extra dimension in Haggadah. So what are those elements? In other words, what are the biblical, structural, elements of Haggadah, or of Sippur, that were the blueprint, as it were, for the formation of the Haggadah. Right? The Haggadah is a rabbinic work, but it is building on the structural bricks that define what is the mitzvah of Sippur Yetziat Mitzrayim. So it is said that the... Yeah?
What did you say that you are an individual thing? You think yourself, you remind yourself, you remember yourself, but Sippur, however,
Right. So certainly that would be true. Okay. That would certainly be true that Zechirah the whole year does not involve any obligation to talk to anybody else, and Sippur requires sharing it. On the other hand, if, as the Rambam writes, there is a mitzvah of Haggadah, even if you're all by yourself, so vis-a-vis the person who's by himself, Would there be anything that Sippur requires over Zechirah? Right, that would be. You are correct. Certainly, one element would be that if there is somebody you could tell it over to, there would be an obligation to do that. Right. So it doesn't completely answer the question, but it's good. Certainly, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting along his lines that maybe the mitzvah of Sippur, even when you're by yourself, is to give you the narrative skills to be prepared to recount it to somebody else eventually. Okay, well, those are both interesting thoughts. It's kind of preparing yourself for the occasion in which you will be able to narrate. But it is said that the great sage of Chaim Soloveitchik, maybe some of you, I'm sure most of you have heard of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University, who died now, I guess, 5 years ago, 7 years ago, 1993. And his grandfather was one of the great sages. He died around World War I. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was the rabbi of Brisk in Lithuania, considered to be one of the great analytical minds. A student of Rav Chaim left the yeshiva and became non-religious, and became a great physicist who was a protege of Einstein, Albert Einstein. So he once came back to visit his old friends. So he was talking about what a brilliant man Einstein was, and also what a fine man he was. Einstein was a very, very, very fine person in terms of his character traits and the like. So then the obvious question that his old friends would want to know is, yeah, how does he compare to Rav Chaim? You know, how does Einstein put his existence? Rav Chaim, what type of comparison is this? You know, you have to have 20 Einsteins to be a Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. But all right. Now this is the story that the Briskers say. I'm not sure. but this is what they say. Anyway, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to explain, as an introduction to the Seder, to kind of give a structure to the Seder, that looking at the Talmud and the Mishnah, there are four basic structural elements that differentiate Sippur from Zechirah, and they are the foundational blocks of the Haggadah. Element number one is, now remember, these are focusing on how is the special mitzvah of Sippur to be differentiated from Zechirah, right? That's our question. So element number one is that Sippur, or Haggadah, those are the same, must be Derech She'ela U'tshuva. It's not enough, like Jeopardy, just to give an answer. There must be questions which are being answered. And this is of course the four questions, the Manishtana, but it's important to remember once again that the Talmud tells us that the Manishtana is not only if you have someone asking you a question like a child, but even if you're by yourself. It's not enough to tell the story. The story must be prefaced by questions. We'll discuss why that is so, but clearly, this is based on Ki Yishalcha Bincha. The Torah describes Haggadah as when your child asks you. And clearly, the concept here is that Zechirah, the whole year, does not require any question. I just make a statement. God took me out of Egypt. But a unique focus of the Haggadah is there must be a She'ela U'tshuva. Again, I'll discuss why that would be so, but at least in terms of noting the phenomenon, there is a requirement of questions. By the way, according to many commentaries, the questions do not have to be the Manishtana. The Manishtana are simply sample questions for those who can't think of their own. There's actually a passage in the Talmud where one of the rabbis, as a young child, asked some question about something going on in the Seder, and his uncle said, okay, we don't have to say the Manishtana. You fulfilled the obligation of questions. So the Manishtana, in a sense, is a question, series of questions for those who are not bright enough to think of their own difficulties that they would like to raise. Now again, our custom is not that way. All of us should say the Manishtana. Our custom is, or at least have the children say it. Our custom is that this is the part of the text of the Haggadah, but there is at least some suggestion that originally it was just a bunch of sample questions, which could be replaced by other questions that a person has. But that's element number one. I'm sorry, do you want to say?
Yeah, I'm wondering on the basis of what we're saying, because we want to fulfill his mitzvah of Zechirah through Sipirah.
Through Sipur?
Yeah, through Sipur, can you fulfill your mitzvah?
Yeah, yeah, apparently yes. Meaning to say, since Sipur is more extensive than Zechirah, it would seem obvious that by the more extensive obligations of the mitzvah, you could fulfill the less extensive. It's the opposite that's not true, right? You can't fulfill Sipur by a Zechirah, but you can do it the other way. That is correct, yeah.
So you fulfill your mitzvah of Zechirah Pesach night. Every night we have a mitzvah of Zechirah.
That's correct. It would appear, although maybe there's a question of you know, Einos and mitzvah chavil chavil, because you try not to do a lot of mitzvahs, you know, you try to keep each one separately, I don't know, but certainly in the abstract, a long narrative of Sipur would be a fulfillment of Zechirah. Yeah. So that's, again, I'll go back over each of these, but I just want to enumerate them first. So Sheila Utshuva is element number one, and that finds its expression in the Haggadah through the Manishtana, questions. Element number two that Rav Chaim identified based on, again, this is all based on Talmudic sources, is that in the mitzvah of Zechirah, I only got to talk about God took me out of Egypt. I don't have to describe the slavery, I just describe the redemption. But when it comes to Sipur, it is not enough just to talk about the good parts. But there is, in the language of the Mishnah, matchil bignut. You must begin with the degradation. You must begin with the humiliation and the suffering and the pain. And only then, misayem bishvach, do you conclude with the praiseworthy things that God has done for us. Meaning the whole year, you just mention the good. God saved me. Pesach night, you got to start from the beginning of the story. Now, interestingly enough, the Mishnah uses the enigmatic term gnut, meaning something bad or negative. But there's a machloket in the Gemara. What is the negative that the Mishnah refers to? According to one opinion, the negative is avadim hayinu, we were slaves. The negative is the slavery. According to the other opinion, it is the fact that we were originally idolaters before Abraham. Mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoteinu. Now, you might be saying, well, wait a second, doesn't our Haggadah have both of those things? The answer is, the Talmud says, since it is unresolved whether the law is in accordance with the first opinion or the second opinion, our Haggadot are composite Haggadot. Very, very fascinating. Meaning, our Haggadah is an amalgamation of two different metamorphoses. The metamorphosis from slavery to freedom, and the metamorphosis from paganism to ethical monotheism. Meaning, there was a machloket. What should have been the primary emphasis of the story of Pesach night? And our Haggadah incorporates both. Now, it would be very interesting. This was a machloket between Rav and Shmuel. It would be very interesting. We don't have any manuscripts which gives me Rav's Haggadah or Shmuel's Haggadah. You know, which one, you know, which would have been left out of each Haggadah, etc. But nevertheless, there is a machloket. What is the gnut? What is the negative that you need to emphasize? But according to both opinions, you got to emphasize the negative as well as the positive, and that is unique to Sipur. That does not apply to Zechirah. That's element number two. Element number three is a statement in the Haggadah from Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel was one of the heads of the Sanhedrin, and he says the following, and this is a statement that is right before the second cup, right before you drink the second cup. Rabban Gamliel haya omer, Rabban Gamliel used to say, Call me Shelo Amar Shlosha Devarim Elu B'Pesach. Anyone who does not explain the significance of three rituals that we do on Pesach night, and the three rituals are Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, which we don't have today because we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, but that is commemorated by the Shenkel, Matzah, the eating of the Matzah, and the Marar, and the eating of the bitter herb, Lo Yatsa Yedei Chovato, has not fulfilled his mitzvah. What mitzvah has he not fulfilled? He has not fulfilled the mitzvah of Haggadah. The mitzvah of Haggadah, therefore, is that you must connect the story to the significance of the physical actions of eating the Karban Pesach, the Matzah, and the Marah. That, of course, is a unique feature of Sipur. The rest of the year, I don't have to talk about Matzah and Maror and Pesach. I just talk about the Exodus, right? So that itself is unique. By the way, let me throw out another simple question. In other words, there are questions I don't necessarily want to spend time on, but you know, since Haggadah does require questions, so I think there's value to questions, even if we're not going to answer them in great detail. And that is, this issue about matzah, you know, once you start thinking about it, matzah is much more complicated than we think. Matzah, right, I mean, Gamliel himself says it, or the Torah itself says it, that what happened, the Jews get kicked out of Egypt Pesach morning. Actually, if you recall, Paro told them, get out of my country, midnight. After the firstborn died, Paro came to Moshe and Aaron and said, I've had enough, get out. But we know that God did not want the Jewish people to leave in the middle of the night, because it would look as if they were trying to escape. And if you remember when the Baltimore Colts left Baltimore, you know, they left in the middle of the night, so nobody, Bob Irsay, so nobody would know that the Colts were leaving. Well, God didn't want the Jewish people to leave Egypt, like, you know, the Baltimore Colts left, the former Baltimore Colts left Baltimore. So they waited until the morning. But in the morning, first thing in the morning, they were evicted from Egypt, and the Pasuk says that they were in such a rush. And Kabbalistically, it also means spiritually they had to leave, because it says that they were on the 49th level of impurity. If they would have stayed another minute, they would have hit the 50th level and they would have been irredeemable. That's what the Ari says. But the Pasuk says that the Egyptians demanded that they leave, and therefore they didn't even have time to let their dough rise before they had to bake it. So they had to bake it right away, and hence they had to eat matzah. And Rabbi Gamliel says, the reason we eat matzah, and by extension, the reason why chametz is forbidden, is to commemorate the hurried redemption of the Jewish people from Egypt. Right? This is what Rabbi Gamliel says, and this seems to be what the Pasuk says. Now here is the obvious question. The implication is that if the Egyptians would have given them time, let's say the Egyptians would have told them in the morning, hey, you got to be out of here, like the hotel, you got to be out of here by 2 p.m., they would have let their dough rise, and they would have had chametz. It's only because they had to get out that they didn't have time to let their dough rise. Well, there's an obvious problem here. First of all, if you look at the commandments of the Torah before that event, that night, the night before, they already had to eat matzah with the Karban Pesach. And not only that, but it says for 7 days, because the holiday of Pesach is only 7 days in outside of Israel, we keep it 8 days because of calendrical doubt, but for 7 days, you cannot eat leavened bread. So, how can we say, we're going in a circle, how can we say the reason we eat matzah and don't eat chametz is because they didn't have time to let their dough rise? They weren't allowed to let their dough rise. They already were told they couldn't have chametz anyway. And it doesn't even make sense to say, well, God knew the future and gave them the commandment, because it's a little different, because if God gave them a commandment that they couldn't let their dough rise, then they couldn't let their dough rise. It has nothing to do. It has nothing to do with being rushed. I mean, you've destroyed the whole significance of it. Right? So there's a catch 22 here. So the way the Ran and other commentaries explain it is the following: that matzah itself has more than one reason. Matzah is a dual symbolism food. Matzah on one level is a commemoration of the fact that when the Jews left Egypt, they had to do so speedily that they did not have time to let their dough rise. And therefore, whenever we eat matzah, we remember the redemption of the Jews from Egypt. That is one reason for matzah. But there is another reason for matzah as well, and that is matzah is called lechem oni, the bread of affliction, the bread of poverty. And this is because when the Jews were slaves, they would eat matzah. And the Ibn Ezra points out that Ibn Ezra was a great traveler, that when he went to India, he noticed that the masters would force their slaves to eat matzah. The reason the Ibn Ezra suggests is because matzah stays in your stomach a long time, and as a result, the masters save on the amount of food, right? You eat a little matzah, it kind of stays with you for the entire day. Others say the reason slaves eat matzah is simply because slaves don't have time to let their dough rise. They got to bake it as quickly as possible. Now, therefore, the following. Matzah is both a zecher li'avdut, it is a commemoration of slavery, and a zecher li'geula, and a commemoration of redemption. And this is actually alluded to in the two main references to matzah. Because at the very beginning of the Seder, we have a reference to matzah, which we say in Aramaic. It is the only part of the Seder that is in Aramaic, because that used to be the vernacular of the Jews in Babylon. Ha lachma anya, this is the bread of affliction, the achalu avatana b'yarud mitzrayim, that our forefathers ate in Egypt. That is not Rabban Gamliel's reason that he gives later. That is saying that the matzah is a commemoration of affliction and poverty, slavery. Rabban Gamliel then says there is an additional element of matzah. Matzah reminds us that our forefathers didn't have time to let the dough rise. Okay, yeah, no, it's very good. Again, that's a good point. Basically, what chametz is the fermentation process. When flour and water get mixed in, after a certain amount of time, fermentation and puffing occurs, and that is what halachically defines something as chametz. Now, theoretically, there's nothing magic about 18 minutes, meaning even if it's been 20 minutes, if I haven't observed the puffing, it's not chametz. However, the rabbi said, based on observation, that as a general rule of thumb, fermentation of dough tends to occur at the 18 minutes and beyond point. And consequently, since we're not always sure if we can observe empirically the correct signs of fermentation, we adopt a universal rule of thumb that after 18 minutes we treat it like chametz. But it's really just a presumption as to the fermentation. Chametz is defined by fermentation, not by minutes per se. Okay, so I didn't answer my question. So we have these dual symbols of matzah. So the commentaries say the following. The first Mitzrayim, the first Pesach in Egypt, right, the first Seder, they did eat matzah with the Korban Pesach. But that was not in a commemoration of redemption, because that didn't happen until the next day. The whole story that their dough didn't have time to rise happened the day after the Seder. So what was the reason they ate matzah night number one? The reason they ate matzah night number one was exclusively because of the motif of lechem oni, to remember their poverty and their affliction and their slavery in the moment of their joy. And consequently, it was suggested that for that first year, there was not yet a prohibition of chametz for all 7 days. Although it does say in the Torah, you can't eat chametz for 7 days, but if you look at the psukim very carefully, it seems to say that God is saying that when you come to Israel, you will not be allowed to eat chametz for 7 days. And God didn't give the reason for that, but the reason for that was because of the event that occurred the next morning. But what I mean to say is that the next morning, they would have been allowed to bake chametz, except for the fact that they were kicked out earlier. And when they realized that they were forced to have it matzah because they were kicked out earlier, they now understand in retrospect why God said, from now on, you can't eat chametz in commemoration of this event. In other words, the point is that particular year only, that particular year, by the next day, they would have been permitted to have chametz, but they didn't, because the Egyptians did not let them have their dough rise. And in commemoration of that event, the law of chametz became applicable for the entire 7 days. That's how we learn. Meaning to say, what that means is, therefore, that matzah was a mitzvah that originally had only one significance. It was the first Seder. Matzah meant only one thing, but from every other Seder thereafter, matzah acquired an additional significance, the significance of freedom. But you see the issue. Matzah did not become a freedom symbol till the next day, the first night of Pesach wasn't. And of course, it's a delicious irony, and of course an intentional irony, that the very vehicle that symbolized their slavery and degradation became the symbol of freedom and redemption as well. The Egyptians forced us to eat matzah, and the matzah was the food that symbolized God redeeming us from Egypt. Yeah. Well, it is interesting that I'm trying to think the origin of matzah. I mean, matzah is used in the Torah for unleavened bread. I mean, it is a chumash word. It's not a rabbinic word, but in terms of the shorish, it is connected to something that is that liquid has been squeezed out of it, like mitz. Mitz is juice, but mitzitzah is to squeeze. So it seems to refer to the dryness of the bread in which the moisture is squeezed out of it. That seems to be what it's connected to. But that is matzah. Now, the thing is, by the way, chametz is also very interesting. Chametz is very interesting. Now, chametz, which we use for leavened bread, if you look in Yeshayahu, for example, in the books of the prophets, we find Ishru chametz. That means defend the oppressed. A chamutz is an oppressed person. So chametz connotes the notion of oppression, and it's connected to the idea that the bread of chametz is arrogant and puffed up, and therefore it represents the oppressor that preys on those who are vulnerable. Right? So, and you actually find in many, many places in Tanakh that chamutz refers to those who are oppressed by the chametz. Right? And of course, chometz, which is vinegar, is also connected to that which spoils. Because it's very interesting. Matzah cannot spoil. Matzah can get a little stale. But you know, they found matzah in Masada, I believe, and they still believe that it's edible. Maybe that's, sometimes we feel like we'll get that in our box of shmur matzah, back from Masada. But chometz, however, once bread becomes chometz, it of course acquires the ability to get moldy and to get rancid and to get spoiled. That once again suggests that the inner arrogance of being puffed up can create a rot and a spoilage that the matzah cannot have. Okay, so that's what I suggest, that matzah comes from mitzitzah, to squeeze out, and chametz comes from a word which is connected to oppression. Sorry, what?
When someone ordered them to leave at midnight, didn't the dough have all night to rise?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In other words, it seems if they were told at midnight to get out, then they had 6 hours to make bread.
No.
Why not?
With all the other packing, you have to do
packing. Okay. It could be. You're right. You know, maybe they wanted fresh bread, and they figured that they would make fresh bread in the morning. It might be. It is a good question, but you know, again, the answer might be the logistics of leaving. You know, it's, in fact, it's very, very interesting. You know, it's hard for us. We sometimes don't picture, you know, what the physical scene must have been like. And you know, in a way, it's very beautifully captured in all places in Negro spirituals, Black spirituals, is the ones that is coming back from their slavery, in which they use the Exodus in very, very vivid imagery, and you really had a sense of what it was like to go to the Promised Land. And I wouldn't suggest necessarily that they become Pesach songs, but you know, it wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing either. So there's either some very interesting sense of personalizing that feeling of the Exodus. Okay, but being as a may, I just want to bring out that the issue of matzah is a much more complicated issue than people make it out to be, because there was the mitzvah of matzah even before the historical event for which matzah is attributable, and that connects to the fact that matzah has two symbols. But going back to the main thing, our main thread here, we've identified three building blocks of Sipur. One is question and answer. Two is you've got to begin with the bad and culminate with the good. Three, you got to explicate and connect your narrative with Pesach, Matzah, and Marar, which you do not have to do in the mitzvah of Zechirah the whole year. And the fourth element is what we actually talked about last week, and that is Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo. A person must personally look at themselves, Ki Ilu Hu Yatsa Mi Mitzrayim, as if they themselves had left Egypt. Meaning, during the year, it's Zechirah, memory. You remember what Hashem did. Pesach night, it is not memory, it is experience. Very, very different. Zechirah, in fact, means memory. There is no obligation every day to feel as if Hashem took me out of Egypt today. But Pesach night, there is Chayav Adam Lirot Es Atzmo. I'm not sure, I may have mentioned that according to the Rambam makes this mitzvah much easier. The Rambam changes one letter. The Rambam does not say lirot, you must feel, but laharot, you must show by behavior. So the Rambam says, that's why we recline, to be free, because in the olden days they would recline on couches. That's why we drink four cups of wine. According to the Rambam, the Torah is not commanding your emotions. The Torah, as it were, is dictating behavior. However, our Haggadot do not say laharot et atzmo. Our Haggadot say lirot. You must personally see yourself. And it was said by many that this is the hardest mitzvah of Pesach, as hard as cleaning for Pesach is, to reach that emotional state. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik briefly told us, therefore, that if we were to ask, this was our question, what is the difference between the mitzvah of Zechirah the whole year and the mitzvah of Sippur on the night of Pesach, the structural differences are four. She'ela u'tshuva, number one. Number two, matchil bignut u'misayeh b'shvach, you must begin with the bad part. Number three, you must integrate your narrative with Pesach, Matzah, and Marar. And number four, the imperative of experience and not just memory, and that is chayav adam lirot es atzmo. Now, provided you incorporated those four elements, you could do any Haggadah you want. We happen to have a text. The Torah does not mandate a precise text, but the Torah does mandate a structure that incorporates these four elements. This is the blueprint upon which the Haggadah was built. This is what Rav Chaim used to tell his family before every Seder, so they should understand exactly what is the structure. And by the way, if you think about it, a lot of the Haggadah, in fact, a lot of the most beloved parts of the Haggadah are really totally introductory in nature. The whole passage of the four sons is really just an introduction, because it's simply saying that the mitzvah of telling the Haggadah to our children necessitates that we adjust the story to each type of child and to each personality. In other words, you're not actually doing anything then. You're simply being reminded as to how you do it. Okay, that's why people often, even in the most religious home, they often spend a tremendous amount of disproportionate time when they give commentaries and insights on the four sons or things like that, which is not really the Haggadah. That's really a long introduction telling us that when we start talking about the Haggadah, we should key it to the particular needs and personalities of each type of child that we have. Yeah.
The fourth way of saying in Sikkot, I don't
know
if it has to do with that. I always thought that was a separate mitzvah, but the person has to see. It's part of Sikkot?
Yes, so Rav Chaim says it is not a separate mitzvah, it is actually a component. Because again, the whole pasuk of Sipur is V'higadetel Levincha, you shall tell your child, V'yomuhu Leimor, Bavor zeh asa Hashem li, because of what Hashem did to me, am I doing this? So Rav Chaim says it is the essence of the mitzvah of Sippur that you have to feel and communicate as if it's happening to you. That is Sippur. It's not a separate mitzvah. It is part of Sippur Yetzias Mitzrayim itself. So these are Rav Chaim's four structural elements of the Haggadah. Now what I want to do is, and this is a bit of a bridge, because Rav Chaim was from one of the great, great non-Hasidic, great Mitznaget families in Europe. Obviously Rav Chaim was not connected to Hasidut in any way, but I want to use Rav Chaim's elements and connect them to a Hasidic interpretation, which kind of gives us the spiritual meaning of each of these four elements. I remember last week, what we were trying to talk about last week was the notion that Yitziat Mitzrayim exists on many, many different levels. There is the historical exodus of Egypt, which of course is pivotal to the formation of the Jewish people, and culminated in the receiving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. But there's also a personal Egypt, a personal Mitzrayim that exists within every person. And remember too that the word Mitzrayim can come from Meitzar. David HaMelech says, Min HaMeitzar Karatika, out of the narrow confines I call out to you, God. So Meitzar is that which blocks us, which traps us, which doesn't enable us to function with the holiness that we have. And every person can have their slavery and their Mitzrayim. We talked about last week how jealousy and envy and a desire for ego glory can destroy a person, like kinah, tava, and kavod, etc. So when we talk about Yitziat Mitzrayim, it is not only the historical Mitzrayim that we are talking about, but we're also talking about the Mitzrayim within us that enslaves us. And Yitziat Mitzrayim means God gives us the capacity during this time of year to become liberated from whatever it is that enslaves us. And that's the, again, I don't want to say that's the only meaning, because obviously we are obligated to talk about the historical Mitzrayim and the plagues and how that was so pivotal for the formation of the Jewish relationship with God. There's no doubt about that. But there are secondary aspects of the Haggadah as well, in which one focuses on their own enslavements and how they become liberated from that which enslaves us. Remember I mentioned that's why Pesach is in the springtime, because the spring is when even the physical vegetation of the earth becomes liberated from the imprisonments of the winter, and that is a sign of the spiritual forces in the air that can liberate us and give us a sense of freedom. In this sense, Rav Chaim's four structural characteristics ties very well with the Hasidic emphasis on the personal existential aspect of Yitziat Mitzrayim. And that is, in a sense, it is a blueprint for the spiritual seeker. And let's take each of these elements. Element number one, She'ela U'tshuva. That tells us that to grow in spirituality, one must have the willingness to ask honest questions. Now, Judaism, in a sense, is very unique in this way. Many religions, over their years, actively discouraged people asking questions. In fact, the Catholic Church, for much of the Middle Ages, discouraged people from becoming literate, because they wanted literacy, which meant control over the biblical text, to be limited to the clergy, so that you had to accept what they said, and you'd have no way of calling them on it, no way of questioning, no way of raising any type of issue, because you were not able to read. And there actually was a calculated campaign that, except for the clergy, illiteracy is not something that should be available to the common person. Judaism, we know, is absolutely the opposite, and it has always been the opposite, that every single person is obligated to try to study Torah, try to know Torah, try to learn Torah, try to understand. And Judaism encourages questions and inquiry. It does so in a sense of modesty and humility. We all have to recognize our limits. We all have to recognize that the ways of God are to a large degree inscrutable and beyond our comprehension. But we still have an obligation to try to go as far as we can to understand whatever it is we can. Judaism welcomes questions. It encourages questions. And it recognizes that without questions there will not be insight. Without questions there will not be growth. At the same time, there is a question and there is a question. There is a question that represents a sincere desire to learn and to understand, which is cherished and blessed. But then there is a question that is just a rhetorical question, in which a person is merely expressing resentment and hostility. And that is not really a question. That is really an answer. In other words, you're asking a question. And here the commentaries say a very interesting thing. And this goes back to the four sons. If you remember how the four sons part of Haggadah works, basically the Torah does not label. The Torah says in four different places, the Torah talks about your child asking you something about Egypt, and you have to respond. And it doesn't say which is which. But the Haggadah says, well, one pasuk seems to refer to the wise son, one pasuk seems to refer to the bad son, etc. In other words, it's simply tagging a label on these four different verses. Now, here's the question. Why do we identify a pasuk as belonging to the bad son's question? What is so bad about it? So if you remember, what does the Rasha say? The Rasha says, Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem. Why are you doing this work? So the Haggadah jumps on the word, why are you doing this work? Why doesn't he say, why aren't we doing this work? He's implying he doesn't want to do it. Ah, he excludes himself from the congregation, so we give him a harsh answer. Why am I doing it? I'm doing it because God took me out of Egypt. In other words, the implication is, if you would have been there, you wouldn't have been taken out. In other words, it's kind of answering him in accordance with the way he's talking. He's talking, why am I doing it and not him? Because of what God did to me and not you. But that's the symmetry of the answer. Even then, by the way, I want to emphasize, you know, Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say that even this fourth son, who seems to be hostile and rejecting, does have a certain merit, because at least he's showing up. So Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say, there's a fifth son at the Haggadah, at the Seder. The fifth son is the one that's not there. And the fourth son might be hostile and resentful and would rather be somewhere else, maybe. But at least he's engaging you, even in negativity. And even the answer you give back to him shouldn't always be understood as negative as you might think. Because what you're telling the son is, it's kind of a tough love response. You're telling the son, listen, if you want to shape up and be a person that's worthy of redemption, you have to be willing to participate in the divine service. You can't have the good part without the responsibilities. So all you're telling the Rasha is, if you would have been there with your attitude, you wouldn't have gotten out, but therefore what? Change your attitude. It's kind of a way of response. It's not as rejecting as one would assume, but nevertheless, what makes us label him as the bad one? Because he says, why are you doing it? And he doesn't say, why are we doing it? Well, one of the famous questions that everybody asks is, well, listen, look at the question of the wise son, the good son, the scholar. Now, he has a fancier question. He has a more elaborate question. What is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the laws? So he has a sense of halachic structure that Hashem, our God, has commanded you. He also says, God has commanded you. Shouldn't he be condemned for the same language? So the commentaries point out many, many differences, because on one hand, he does say, God, our God, Hashem Elokeinu, etc. Some say that the Rasha's problem is, he calls it avodah, which is work. That's a difficult pshat, really, because avodah in the Chumash often means very, very positive service of God. But one explanation, which is a very brilliant explanation, but unfortunately, you don't see it in the Haggadah. And that is, the difference between the Rasha and the Chacham, and why one pasuk is labeled as the bad son, and one is labeled as the wise son, is because of the way their question is prefaced. In other words, prefaced in the words immediately before their question. And that is, the Chacham's question is prefaced, Ki yishalcha bincha, when your child asks you. The Rasha's so-called question is prefaced, Ki yomru aleichem b'neichem, when your son tells you. The difference is, the Chacham is asking, the Rasha is telling. Now again, it's a little strange that the Haggadah does not quote that part of it, since that is so essential, but nevertheless in the Chumash itself it's very clear. Meaning, Judaism welcomes questions which are a quest for knowledge, but one should do so with a sense of respect and reverence, and not with a sense of disparagement and anger.
It might just be that this particular Haggadah actually translated and translated as prefaced, and that it's
wow, that's unfortunate. I mean, I That's what they call it, Bowdlerism. You don't just, Bowdlerization, you don't just change it. Well, the Hebrew doesn't say that. That's correct. All right, that's just a little disturbing. Yeah. Yes, yes, excellent point, excellent point. If you look at the Haggadah very carefully, you see that the so-called pejorative answer that we give the bad son, that is because of what God did for me and not for you, we use that same pasuk for the fourth child who doesn't even know what to ask. We don't make the point, me and not for you, we quote the same verse. But based on what I said before, there's an answer to this. Because what you're really telling the Rasha is, you're not telling the Rasha, you're no good and you'll never be good. You're telling the Rasha, listen, with your attitude, you would not be deserving of redemption. So I'm inviting you to change. Well, in truth, that's the same answer to the one that's totally ignorant. You're basically saying, listen, with total ignorance and non-connection, you too could not merit redemption. But let me help you to change by education. In other words, if it's understood not as a rejection, but a call for constructive growth, then indeed it would apply to the Eino Yodea L'Shol as well. That's the point, that it's not intended to be an insult. And I think that would actually be a proof that that's the way you properly interpret it. Okay, but be it as it may, you know, it's very, very interesting that the term that we use in Judaism for a great Torah scholar is Talmid Chacham. Now, Talmid Chacham literally means a student of the wise. Why don't you call him a Chacham? As far as I didn't actually call a rabbi a Chacham, but usually in the Gemara, usually, not always, we refer to a scholar as a Talmid Chacham. And part of that is, and certainly in modern Hebrew we tend to do that. The reason that is so is because the true sign of wisdom is you always want to learn. That it is the perpetual Talmid within us that is the greatest sign of wisdom. The person that says, I know it all, I have it all, I no longer have to grow, I no longer have to be challenged, and I no longer have to seek wisdom, is by definition defective in that wisdom. It is the students, the desire to learn. Where did I once heard a well-known law professor of mine, I don't want to mention his name, but he once said that, well, the first 20 years he listens, and the next 60 years he's going to talk. You know, basically, he says that, you know, he's heard enough of what other people have to say, but he's going to now spend the rest of his life now kind of expressing his views on things. And this is really the opposite of the attitude of the Talmid Chacham, that one should always be trying to learn. So that's the implication of She'ila U'Tshuva. Ask a question, and that's how you grow. The second idea, begin with the negative and culminate in the positive. Now, let's focus on that for a second. Why is it so important in the Haggadah that I got to talk about the slavery? Why can't I just talk about the good things that God did? Why do I have to talk about all the bad things? So there are two explanations. One explanation is simple and commonsensical, and that is, it is the nature of human beings that we appreciate goodness only when we remember what things were like without it. You know, otherwise we take things for granted. We take health for granted until, God forbid, there may have been illness. We take family for granted until, God forbid, we lose them or we're on the verge of losing them. Right? So it's the nature of a human being that the gifts of freedom are not appreciated that much unless we remember the degradation of slavery. Right? So part of it, therefore, is simply a before and after. In order to appreciate the after, you got to remember the before. That would be the simplest interpretation of Matchilin Bignut U'Misayim B'Shvach. But there is a deeper explanation. And that is, remembering the bad times is not simply an example of a before and an after. But rather, there is something that the bad times gave us which we wouldn't have had without the bad times. How is that so? There's a remarkable, you know, in this area, you know, one of the phenomena of 20th century, not 21st century, United States, is the phenomenon of widespread victimization. Right? Everybody in the world is a victim of something. So the rapist is a victim of childhood trauma, etc. Everybody is a victim. And victimization basically means I look at all of the things that have happened to me and I develop a certain shell in which my goal in life is to be sure that I don't get victimized again. Now, there's a remarkable, now the Jews have been victimized, but the Jews were certainly victimized in Mitzrayim. And there's a remarkable pasuk in the Torah really just a very, very wonderful, wonderful moral idea of how one responds to adversity. And the Torah says, V'yahavtem et hager, you must love the convert, but literally, the convert to Judaism, it literally means a stranger. Don't forget that term. You must love the stranger. Ki geirim hayitem b'yaretz Mitzrayim. Because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. What does the Torah say? What is a ger? In those days, certainly that was the case. A ger is a person who comes, who joins the Jewish people without family, without money, without resources, without connections. They come lonely, isolated, vulnerable, and downtrodden. And God says to the Jewish people, you know what it's like to be poor. You know what it's like to be downtrodden. You know what it's like to be vulnerable. Draw on that memory, not to give you a sense of bitterness or anger against the world, but draw on that memory to have within your heart the qualities of compassion and empathy for those who suffer, because you know what it's like to suffer. Meaning to say, contrary to the notion that because I have suffered, my goal in life is to make sure I don't suffer. To develop within you compassion and empathy for those who are downtrodden and oppressed, because you know what it's like. And when you know what it's like, you will feel, in a serious way, I don't mean President Clinton's expression, you will feel the pain of another. You will feel the suffering of another, because you know what that person is going through. In a sense, although Judaism does not preach self-mortification, right? We don't preach, you know, lie on a bed of nails and wear a hair shirt. We don't teach that. But in a sense, the historical oppression of the Jewish people is considered, in some ways at least, to have given us something very positive and very precious. And that is a sense of care and concern and empathy for those who are suffering. This was a gift that we got, not from the redemption from Egypt, but this is a gift that we got from the slavery experience itself. That's why it's no accident, really, that Jews were so active in the civil rights movement. And that's why it's no accident that Jews were so active in every social revolutionary movement. Sometimes it was misguided, like